Hello, welcome along to the Let's Get Running podcast. I'm Sean Dixon. Thanks a lot for downloading or listening, or whatever you're doing right about now. It's very kind of you to tune in. This week's interview is with Noel Thatcher. Now, Noel's list of accolades is long. He's been to 6 Paralympic Games, he's won 5 medals, and he's broken numerous world records. He's also been honoured by the Queen, given an MBE for his services to athletics and disabled sport. And he was also in 2009 inducted to the England Athletics Hall of Fame. So essentially we're speaking to running royalty this week. Now, if you enjoyed the interview, I'd love a review on iTunes or whatever else you listen to. It'd be great to spread the word. Enjoy the show.
So now, what initially sparked your interest in running?
Well, I was born with a visual impairment, so I've got a condition called optic atrophy, which is a degenerative disease of the optic nerves and the retina. And to cut a long story short, when I was 10, my parents took a decision to send me off to a boarding school for the blind and visually impaired, where they felt I'd get a better standard of education. And part of the school routine was we were made to go running 3 times a week in all weathers and all seasons. And I absolutely hated it with a passion. And to cut another long story very short, when I was 12, I got caught by one of the teachers. I'd sloped off after one of these house runs and to have my one and only fag with a mate of mine and a disused railway siding. And when we hadn't come back after 90 minutes, they had sent out a search party. And the long and short of it, they smelt our breath. We got sussed out straight away. And the punishment for this was to be sent out every night for us to do 5 miles around the lanes of Coventry where the school was. And the teacher would follow us in his car, and as soon as we stopped to walk or chat or slow down, he'd leap out from behind our heads. And of course we were visually impaired, so we couldn't see where he was coming from. And sort of, you know, forced us to keep going. So after this kind of intense months of Kenyan-esque training,
yeah,
I had no talent at all. I'd never featured in any school runs at all. I think in the cross country I was about 83rd out of 86, and after this month of training, I went back into the school cross country championships and I was 3rd. and I felt really sorry for the guy who was punished with me, because he had even less talent and he didn't get anything out of it at all. But as a result of that, I kind of discovered that, you know, winning brings you a little bit of kudos in a boarding school. It's quite a confined environment, so be good at anything is, you know, it's quite good for your standing within the school community.
Yeah.
That was really the start. And then I started to get involved in schools, cross country races. We had a little league in Coventry, and Nuneaton. And actually, 1 year, a team from my school, it's a team of 4 visually impaired, runners, actually won the Warwickshire Schools. So that was a massive, massive scoop for us, particularly because we're always, the kids in the local community always used to view us with a bit of suspicion. And, you know, kids are kids, so it will be the boys from the special school.
Yeah.
So to take them all down in the cross country was a big deal. It was still one of our proudest moments.
Oh, brilliant. Were you coached back then?
No, I was hugely fortunate. We had, basically, I just ran whatever was available. And we did the whole 3A's 5-star award scheme, as was then. So you could get points for doing a particular time or throwing a particular distance or doing a particular long jump. And we would then, you know, get badges dependent on, you know, different color badges dependent on what sort of points you got. So, you know, the big thing was to try and get the top color badge, which is a gold one, you know, 2 or 3 years your senior. So we just competed amongst ourselves to do that. And then when I was, so my first year of A-levels, when I was 17, I got persuaded by one of my mates to go down to the National Visually Impaired Athletics Championships, and I ran the 400 badly, but won it. And it was at that championship that I bumped into John Anderson, who, fortunately for me, was only lived half a mile away from the school, and he was the coach to the then 5,000 meter world record holder. So within so within a couple of weeks of really starting running seriously, you know, at that sort of level anyway, I was training with, you know, Dave Moorcroft's group, which included him, another 5 guys who'd broken 4 minutes for a mile, and John Graham, who'd run 209 for a marathon. Wow. And a host of other athletes. So That was the, he was the very first coach I had, and I was with John till the mid-1990s. He's just an amazing character. So
yeah, and it's to non-track fans, he's known as the guy of the gladiators, isn't he, the referee?
He is, also, yeah, absolutely. And he was even more vocal in his role as coach. So down in at Perry Bar, where we train, we'd get the board piled in a minibus and go up the M6 to Birmingham three times a week to train. And in those days, the track, you know, we'd have 300 or 400 people on there every Tuesday and Thursday. And you could always hear John's voice. And he was famous. Some of his famous one-liners, like, you know, my granny could do better than that. And she's been dead for 50 years. Or, you know, if you don't run faster, I'll rip your leg off and beat you around the head with a soggy end. So he's kind of old school.
Yeah, yeah. And so initially, when you started taking up this more kind of structured training with John, did you have... Did particular strengths emerge? What was your strengths as an athlete back then?
I was pretty quick. And one of John's sort of focal principles was, you know, to develop speed and then to develop endurance on top of that. So he held me back for about 3 or 4 years. It was years before he let me actually train with the, you know, properly with the 800 and 1500 meter boys. So I ended up doing sort of fours and eights for a long period of time. But, you know, given the number of races I've won by 0.04 of a second, I think, you know, that's been massively useful. And it may well be, it may account for the sort of technically efficient running that I developed. So, you know, we were constantly doing drills. We were constantly doing speed work. Everything was really fast, really intense. There was a lot of emphasis on technique. But yeah. I long to be with the big boys. You know, I long to be doing the 100-mile weeks and training 2 or 3 times a day and getting out on a Sunday and doing 50-mile runs. But he just wouldn't let us.
Yeah.
To that end, I'm eternally grateful, because I think it's very difficult to acquire pure sprinting speed, top-end speed,
yeah,
you know, if you haven't got it when you're young.
Yeah. And I was talking to Jermaine Mays quite a while ago now, and he's speaking about training with the Dibaba sisters and a group of other Ethiopian athletes. I can't remember the names of all of them, but he said they did some kind of sprinting every day in the session. And you look at those guys and look how beautifully and efficiently they run, and it's got to be down to that, hasn't it? It's got to be down to keeping that speed going and keeping touching on that every day that keeps you fluent and efficient.
Absolutely. And we were doing 5 track sessions a week in the start, and, you know, lots of 60 meter acceleration runs, 150s, you know, even Dave Moorcroft, you know, his staple sessions were things like, you know, 8 times 300, you know, 4 times 600. He'd be running the 300s in 39:40, you know. And at the time, I didn't think there's anything more of this. I'd be like, okay, so what's the average speed for the fours with the big boys? It's about 40:41. I go, okay, we need to be doing 40:41. It's only, you know, when I sort of stepped back from my career and thought, oh my God, that's like 52 pace. You know, we never really thought of it then, but clearly, you know, it also probably accounted for a significant number of injuries that we had. And within 3 months of starting training with the group, I had 2 tibial stress fractures, which I think, you know, it was just too much load too soon, going on synthetic tracks from running on grass and the school playing fields as well. So I think, you know, lots of lessons to be learned, but, you know, every single person in that group could run a 400 in 50 or faster, you know, so.
Yeah. And what was your sort of first competitive, since you were doing the sort of the 800s and the 1500s, what was your first competitive experience? What did you tend to run when you were that age?
First Europeans, I ran 400 actually, and got a silver, and there was an interesting story there. So as I came across the line, I saw the Polish guy who'd won it lying face down in a pool of sweat and blood on the track, and I was still standing up, and I kind of very quickly realised the difference between gold and the effort required to win gold and silver. So I did fours up until I think 1995, 96 actually is when I debuted in the 800 metres in the World Champs. So that was 4 years after I'd started running internationally, 3 or 4 years after I started running internationally. And I won the world at my first attempt in a right. then world record. So, you know, I think that huge base of speed work really, really, really paid off for me. And then I did sort of 8s and 15s up until Atlanta, where I started, you know, doing 5 and 10 Ks. I naturally moved up. I always wanted to be, you know, part of the Moorcroft kind of legacy, really. Yeah. You know, from training with guys like that and seeing, you know, I lived through the Kohanova era, and there's a huge amount of kudos in those days. But being a miler, you know, so being a 5K runner was where it was at. Those are the events that, you know, you aspire to if you're a young bloke.
Yeah, yeah. What was your first Paralympic experience?
I went, first Paralympics was 1984 when the Paralympics were actually in a different host city. So our games were in Long Island while, you know, the Rocket Man was landing in LA. We were in a university in Long Island, and there were probably more people on the track than there were in the stands. And it probably wasn't the most professional trip I ever made. In between races, we went down to the beach and had a few burgers and went out and enjoyed ourselves in New York. But, you know, I think that, you know, it shows how far the Paralympic movement has come. Yeah, I think I got a silver for the 400, which was the case for 3 years on the trot, actually.
Yeah. I also say, obviously, you went to six in total. Winning, was it between five golds? Wow, fantastic. And your last being 96 in Atlanta.
No, I won the first gold was in Seoul in 1988. Won the 15 in Barcelona in 92, Spaniards, which is fantastic. 5 and 10 in Atlanta, carrying his stress fracture. So that's quite, for me, a massive, massive, massive mental achievement. And then I won the Sydney, the 5K in Sydney, in a world record, having completely blown the 10K because I was still on a kind of mental honeymoon after getting married, that it was got a real looking from my wife after blowing the 10K and then came back and smashed the 5K out, which, so I owe her a lot for that one.
Do you still hold those world records?
No, they've been hammered now. I mean, the standard has rocketed since. Until 15, I held the British record until David Devine broke it in the final in London 2012. He nipped half a second off it, which, let's be fair, he's in far better 5K runner than I ever was. I think you still hold a British record just about 800 metres, but I don't think it'll be long before that goes.
Yeah, and that was amazing. Was it a game, Sydney? Was it obviously the change between the first one you went to and that last one must have been incredible.
Yeah, I think all of the games are very different. You know, Seoul, I had a borderline eating disorder before I went out there, and it was just a miracle I actually got to the start line. And but it was nice to be in the same host city and in the same stadium, albeit a very empty stadium. And then through Barcelona, incredible. Catalan people just amazing, and they just took us to their hearts, and it's fantastic. And Atlanta, very much about, you know, the American sort of Fortune 500 companies, you know, they'd kind of invested a lot in the Olympics, and the Paralympics was the kind of forgotten cousin. Although athletically, it was my best games, you know, won the double. It was fairly poorly supported by the local community. And then Sydney just did on a completely different level. The Australians just loved any kind of sport. They were themselves at that time. Australia was going through a kind of sporting, you know, purple patch in all sorts of sports. After the winning the bronze, actually in the 10K, it took about 3 hours to walk 100 meters to the cafe in the park because we were just getting mobbed by everybody. So that was an entirely different experience. And it's for me when, you know, it felt like we'd started to be accepted on the global stage, you know, for the athletic performance, which was brilliant. You know, validated everything that we'd done up to that point.
Yeah. And you said about the experience with running with stress fracture and still winning Kamaya 2 goals. Is that the performance you look back on and think that was your greatest kind of running?
I don't know. I think Sydney tops it, because I think, you know, the thing about winning as opposed to just running fast is, you know, you've got to get it right when it matters. You know, if you get that small window and, you know, it's 100 meter, you're a 100 meter runner, it's 9.6 seconds. If you're a 5K runner, you know, you get 13 to 15 minutes, whatever it happens to be. And to be able to pull that out of yourself, you know, at 9 o'clock in the evening on that one day in a 4-year cycle requires an entirely different psychological skill set, I think, to just being able to run a fast, you know, BMC. You know, it's incredibly intense, you know, far more so than, you know, I think you can sort of prepare yourself for. And sometimes, not quite often in my case, the best performances have come in the shadow of like Sydney cocking up the 10K, or, you know, in Atlanta having the stress fracture and not being able to run more than 100 meters, 3 meters, 3 weeks before the game. So it's always been in the context of some kind of problem that I've actually managed to dig the best out of myself. You know, Seoul with the eating disorder, not being able to run that well. And funny enough, in Athens, where I was at my happiest, and I probably had the most consistent training, I blew both the 5 and 10K and came fourth twice. So, you know, kind of need something to really sort of dig those performances out of myself.
Yeah, and you think about there about the beginning of that, and not being the most necessarily most talented person, but kind of taking to the training and taking to and dealing with adversity and being strong when it mattered most. Like, do you think that's something that's a real one of the reasons why you've been successful, is that mental toughness?
But I think that's something that was inbred in me from the environment, because, you know, from the first group, and that sounds, makes it sound like the group's really intense, and the training was really, really, you know, really tough. You know, I mean, you know, there weren't that many sessions where you weren't feeling like you're going to throw up afterwards, but you know, it was always a very supportive environment, you know, and I was training with some amazing people as well as some amazing athletes. And I think, yeah, I think we probably learned the racing skills in training, you know. So, you know, you're running 8 times 300 in 40 seconds and there's a pack of 15 of you, you know, running at that speed. You soon learn how to survive. And very good at detecting subtle changes in pace. So the racing brain is very much, I think, developed in the group. You just can't possibly, you know, make a leap from that to sort of running in a Paralympic final level. It has to have been, you know, trained as much as the physical training is. So, but there wasn't, I never had sports psychologists. It was literally just learning from the guys that I was running with, learning, you know, what made them tick. And, you know, Dave Moorcroft's own personal story, the Oslo 5,000 meter world record came in the context of a pretty tough period in his life, you know, and more often than not, it's that then manifests itself as that real, you know, animal sort of visceral, aggressive running. Well, I look at the picture of myself on the start line in Sydney. I look like I'm just about to go out and murder someone. I've got this horrendous, this intense expression on my face. So, you know, I think for me personally, that's been the sort of the mindset, it could potentially be quite a destructive one if you're not able to control it. You know.
Yeah, and you're still running now, obviously. Like, have you? What's your goals at the moment? Are you got anything in the calendar?
Well, I'm a running specialist physiotherapist, and I managed to smash my knee up badly last year. So I'm kind of getting myself back into decent shape now, doing lots of rehab, getting out 4 or 5 times a week, but, hoping to get back, and have a crack at a trail marathon. That's the big draw for me now, you know, just to get away from times and miles and splits and just really enjoy being outdoors. I've got a young 5-year-old son as well who loves junior park runs. I'll go down there and help out and run with him. But for me personally, it's just more about the experience now. I've kind of done the pinning on the number, the intensity, the stress in between sessions, you know, I've had probably 25 years of that. And it's probably more important now to just focus on the actual enjoyment and the process rather than any particular, you know, aspect of the outcome.
Is it Mount Fuji or something you'd like to do there?
UTMF, yeah. But do you know what I thought about that? But actually, I think the course looks horrendous, but I'd love to do a Japanese trail marathon. Obviously, there are no excuses. There are enough visually impaired athletes out there, you know, running amazing, doing amazing things on the trails. But I think UTMF is a little bit technically challenging. I'm not a massive fan of running in the middle of the night. I've done 24 hours on a treadmill as part of a team effort. I think we stick to a marathon somewhere nice and picturesque. Yeah.
How far is that UTMF?
So it's not far of 100 miles, is it? I've got a feeling it's similar sort of distance to UTMB. And 100 miler would be brilliant as well. But I just think, you know, play into my strength. You know, I don't particularly want to be in the middle of a rainstorm, hanging off the side of a sheer cliff. I'll leave that to the hard men.
And do you think, as a visually impaired athlete, have you had to think hard about how you train, and is it? Do you think it's affected the way you've trained and everything?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm so lucky that I've had such an amazing number of guide runners to help me out, and guys mainly from the training groups that I've been in, but. Were it not for them, you know, I wouldn't be able to train 6 months a year, so I can't really see that well to run in the dark. And my first 10-miler I ever did was round Regent's Park with an Australian miler called Pat Scammell. I think he ran 3:51 for a mile. And it was, the audio to that would have sounded like, bang, oh, sorry, mate. Forgot to tell you about that lamppost. Smash. Oh, sorry. So I've kind of got the scars to show it, but, you know, trying to run tempo runs at 5:10 miling in the pitch black, you know, where you literally can't see anything. The only feedback you're getting from your feet is pretty hairy. And I think there's a quite a psychological toil that comes from, you know, constantly running, feeling scared. But, you know, so now again, I'll take it a little bit more steadily, and I've got a little bit more nervous. I've got older, so I tend to take things a little, I don't tend to take as many risks, but yeah, I'm totally, you know, dependent on the support of the guys that I've had in the past, and the medals that I've won are their medals as well.
Yeah. And you said you're a physio now. When did you start that? Were you...
Yeah, no, I started when I was 19. So I did my second Paralympic Games between the second and third years, which was a battle in itself, trying to get time off from the school principal to go and represent your country, which is another challenge. And then I worked on and off all the way through, although I did quite a lot of locum jobs so that I could travel and race when I felt like it. But for the last 12 years, I've been employed full time. I could never really handle the full-time athlete thing. I always needed to have my mind occupied with something else, because you can sit there. If you've done a tempo in the morning, and Alan Story, who coached me in the latter part of my career, would quite often give us two tempos a day, and you just sit there worrying about the pain that you're going to be feeling in 6 or 8 hours. So I was far better off doing something useful. And when I was training for Sydney, I was actually working two separate physio jobs, and I was doing some Japanese courses at SOAS, London University. So I'm one of those people that actually needs to be busy a lot. I'm far better mentally occupied. It definitely helped my running to be mentally, alert and fresh, and not just sitting around, watching Jeremy Kyle and no, I'm joking.
Doing nothing. And it, like, it's for a top athlete, we recognise the importance of physios as kind of almost part of the coaching team. You need the support of various different people to keep your body on track and keep yourself training at a high level. But for the layman, for the non-elite athlete, has it been hard to convince people that physios actually should play more of an important role in how an athlete prepares or a runner prepares for a different event?
I think the main challenge at the moment is there's so much information out there. So if you look through anybody's Twitter feed, there are 150 different running experts all offering various levels and quality of advice. I mean, the simple principles in terms of staying strong, managing your training. So from a physio point of view, call that load management. For a runner's point of view, it's just about monitoring your stress, fatigue levels, and there's lots of really, really, really simple things that anybody can do to reduce their injury risk if they have, but you probably need a physio to guide you through that process. And then we really only ought to be brought into play when things don't go to plan. But I try as far as possible to empower my patients to manage themselves as well. But again, the first point of contact for most runners when they're injured is their mates. So their mates are physio, who's got a degree in physiotherapy and understands strength and conditioning and et cetera, then you kind of quids in. But if your mate literally has learned what he's learned from his mate and then et cetera, then sadly things can turn out not particularly well. So I spend a lot of my time talking common sense to people. That's simple principles applied specifically is my kind of catchphrase, if you like.
Yeah. And whereabouts are you based with the physiotherapy?
So I have a couple of places I work. My main job is at the Holly Private Hospital, which is Buckhurst Hill, northeast London. I do a little bit of work out of the Running Works in the city with that amazing physio, Scott Newton, who I know looked after you pretty well. And it's just become a daddy, so that should be an extra challenge. I work with another one of your good friends from sort of good gym, Ken Hoy, as well. So I've got a sort of core group of people that I work with, but those are the two main centres. And I love every minute of it. It's great to see people, now in the middle of preparing for the London Marathon. It's particularly satisfying to see those people who are nervous about the process come through and achieve what they want to do. Treating elite athletes can be a bit of a challenge sometimes. I'm not saying a word, mate, but equally, it's brilliant to see anybody achieve, what they want to do against some sort of adversity. And I think if I can take anything from my career as a runner, it's learning to self-manage. Because as you pointed out when you sent the questions through, and I was really lucky that although I ran in Atlanta with a stress fracture rather, I never missed a championship injured. And that's just about probably in my case being a little bit, obsessive about monitoring my response to what I was doing. And those skills were learned from the coaches and the other physios that I worked with. So at one time, the physio that looked after me is the now performance director of British Athletics, Neil Black. And I learned a huge amount from him, mostly as a physio, but also as an athlete. So it's super important to manage yourself. It's tough, when you want to be better and better and better and you want to push harder and harder and harder, but sometimes, you just need to slow down a bit.
Yeah. And you're recognised for services to disabled sport in 1997. You got an MBE. What was it like meeting Her Maj?
That was pretty cool. It was slightly odd because I went straight from the investiture to a European Japanese speech contest at SOA. So in the anteroom, I was trying to remember this, you know, 10-minute presentation on, you know, the interpretation of the word disability in Japanese. But it was amazing. I mean, it is incredible. I mean, bearing in mind that at that time, you know, there were hardly any Paralympic athletes who'd been honoured. So, you know, you set out on this journey like everybody else, you know, just running around the grass track at school, and then just suddenly find yourself 14 years later being recognised by, you know, the monarch for that very same activity is incredible. I mean, I would have to say that being inducted into the England Athletics Hall of Fame ranks up there with that, with the MBE, because at the time that I was inducted in 2009, I think the Hall of Fame awards had only been going 2 or 3 years. So they give you this little book up with all the, you know, the inductees in at the end of the night. And I'm flicking through that and it says Seb Kerr and Steve Ovett and wow. Roger Bannister. And I'm going, oh my good God, this is absolutely beyond the wildest dreams. So that to me, again, being recognized by your peers, like carrying the flag in brilliant. Athens at the opening ceremony, that is, I think probably the pinnacle for me.
Yeah. And you're still quite an active sort of campaigner. I think you're a patron of a few charities.
Yeah, I've worked with several organisations, usually organisations that have something to do with visual impairment or disability sport. I also work with Standard Chartered Bank, their Global Preventable Blindness Initiative. But, you know, I'm now starting to do a little bit of work with Junior Parkrun to help promote it, and particularly in the communities where, you know, it's just say exercise is not a massive priority, and sometimes access to exercise is a little bit of a luxury. So we're going to go into some of the less affluent areas and try and spread the word a little bit. But you know, when you see kids running and just loving it, like my son woke up on Sunday morning, I'm so excited to run. You know, that's when, and you know, and I've been out to schools and you wave a gold medal around and you see that little spark in people's eyes, in the children's eyes, and you think, actually, this is where the medals do their most good. You know, this is the real legacy. So I tweeted, the Guardian were banging on about, you know, legacy from the Olympics and Paralympics and in a not particularly positive sense the other week, and I tweeted this picture of me showing my gold medal to a group of children. I was actually teaching Japanese that morning. But these kids, you know, eyes are wide open. I said, well, this is the legacy of, you know, an Olympic or Paralympic gold medal. It's to, you know, motivate, inspire, you know, trigger the imagination of a 9-year-old, you know, to have a crack, you know, see what happens, and maybe it's not the children you motivate, maybe it's a parent or a teacher or anybody, but that's the real value of those medals, because otherwise they'd just be gathering dust in a shoebox at home.
And then this weekend's the national cross country final, and you won't see a mention about on the TV or on the radio or in any sort of major news outlet. And I think that's such a shame when you have such an interest in, like you say, parkrun is booming, junior parkrun, there's a huge interest in people getting out and running and competing. And yet we don't seem to have much of an interest in sport at the very top in Britain, per se. Do you think that's a problem? Do you think that we should be trying to showcase these guys at the very top of our sport in the UK, or are we doing fine without that?
I think we've almost missed a generation, didn't we? It's managed to keep the momentum of the Coast Nomads. I mean, it probably wouldn't be interesting. We went through a patch where we weren't particularly succeeding on a global stage. These days, with, you know, Andy Butchart, Laura Muir, Callum Hawkins, I just seem to find myself just listening to Scottish athletes when I have these conversations. And as an athlete who trained with a Scottish coach, and I trained a little bit with Liz McColgan and prior to her, some other Scottish athletes, I could see why they're doing so well. So I think there's a huge amount of belief there. But getting back to the question about, you know, showcasing athletes, I think, yeah, it's making the sport attractive to young kids. Kids love to run. You know, you don't need to tell a 5-year-old to run. Their natural instinct is to run. Developing that, you know, through schools, you know, cross country's always had a very negative connotation. And it was that ridiculous move to use it as a punishment, wasn't it? But, you know, the clubs are doing their bit. You know, there's some really solid clubs. We've got, you know, good club here in Harlow where I live, with a really strong junior section. I think it's tough these days. You know, we're trying to compete with other sports that have much larger marketing budgets, much larger higher profiles, got more money to throw at development days. So, you know, trying to persuade people that it's, you know, as exciting to, you know, run 9 miles of Parliament Hill Fields as it is to do others is a bit of a challenge. But I think the actual core support for the sport is still rock solid. It's probably healthier than it's been for ages, particularly, you know, with our standing on the aforementioned, you know, Butch Arts and Laura Muir's, you know, going to do a massive amount to sort of motivate the next generation, because there's a homegrown talent. People can identify with those guys. They do take part in their regional cross country championships. They will, you know, race on the roads. They're not afraid to race each other. You know, all of those things that make the sport exciting. You know, British athletes, you know, avoiding each other. Then, you know, and it all gets a little bit showcasey. I think that's when things, the kind of interest drops off. But there's, you know, nothing like, you know, watching a pack of British runners, like last year's London, or was it, where Johnny Hay, sadly didn't have the best days, but I was watching the British race unfold, you know, and all that focus on everybody, Tomo, and, I know you weren't far off the back of that pack, weren't we?
I fell off quite badly.
But that was a brilliant day, you know, and, you know, that's the sort of thing we want more of. Initiatives like the Mile of Miles back in the day where, you know, we'd get Peter Elliott and Steve Cram coming to race in the Harlow track. It was just incredible. That's what we need. We need, you know, good, solid core group of British athletes running in front of British audiences and in the local community, and make it affordable for kids to, you know, to get to see them. And as soon as that starts to happen, then I think we'll be fine. Again, the City of London Mile, I think you've been involved with, you know, that Run Fast put on for a couple of years. I think I had to defer till next year, sadly, for this year. But that's a great event, you know, where it's free to enter. You know, you have kids races, kind of more community sort of recreational athletes up to the kind of top club athletes. And then, you know, guys cracking out sub-4s in the elite race on the same day. That's a fantastic format, you know, great location. Everybody can join in, and that's where people get motivated. So I think it's all positive, and I think, you know, this year Worlds in London should be fantastic. I mean, sold out, you know, oversubscribed tickets, so it's looking good.
I think this year's London's going to be great as well. I think because it will still have, I think, Tomo overall and a few of those other guys are doing it. I think I've heard a couple of other guys in around looking sort of 215 and lower, because obviously the Commonwealth Games qualifying is around this sort of time of year, and the Worlds as well in 2017. So it should be a good dust up this year as well. It should be interesting.
People don't look like they're frightened to actually have a real crack now. And that's what I thought was really great about Johnny Hay, because to be honest, unless he'd had an amazing day, that was always going to end up one way. Yeah. But it's nice to see guys not being afraid to lay it on the line. You know, and I think that's super important. I mean, again, it was a Peter Coe quote, isn't it? That, you know, Seb needed to learn to commit when he actually, you know, got a lot wrong before he got it right. And I think, you know, we need to sort of recapture that. What we could now call the Callum Hawkins spirit. He's kind of inventing a new toughness. He's going to get that Steve Jones thing going on, hasn't he? Where literally he just hammers. And Laura Muir again, Eilish McColgan, you know.
Callum's got to learn to dip though. If you're running down, the finish line and you can go under 50 with under 60 rather with a little dip, he's got to learn to get that dip, that finishing move.
A lot of guys have gone over to Japan and have not been able to reproduce form, you know, and Skorka particularly, it's been a challenge to get to it. But it didn't seem to affect him at all. And, you know, people should be listening to what he's doing, you know, how he's managing to pull those performances out with such an able chart as well. It doesn't seem to matter where he is, what he's doing, you know. They're fearless, they're, you know, warriors. That's what we want.
Yeah. And like, obviously, you know a little bit about the scene in Japan. Is it a bigger, high-profile sport there than it is over in the UK?
Yeah, I mean, Hakone attracts, you know, TV viewing. So Hakone Ekiden, which is the two-day 200K Ekiden over New Year on January the 2nd and 3rd between Tokyo and Hakone. So it's the Tokyo Region University Ekiden. That attracts something ridiculous like 30, 40 million people watching 6 hours of continuous distance running on two consecutive days, you know. And the course is absolutely packed, you know, for 100K. There'll be people every inch of the way on both days. And I think it's still Japan's most viewed sporting event. So there's a huge amount of passion for it. There's a huge, I mean, obviously culturally, you know, the group in Japan is very strong. The company is very strong, you know, but in the case of Hakone, it's about the university. But, you know, this, yeah, I think you've done Fukuoka as well. So you've probably been, you know, in the experience of, you know, 30, 40 runners all going off and running, you know, 64, 65 for the first half of marathon. And most of them blow up, but there's this massive sort of passion. It's almost a little bit naive in its kind of passion. You do wonder sometimes if those guys check themselves just a minute whether they wouldn't be producing more 2:10 to 11 runs, but they just don't seem to care. And just wave after wave of runners coming through. And recently there was a high school 10K where I think 10 runners went sub 30 on the road, you know, in one race. And it's huge. And it's one of the reasons I went to Japan to train, because you could walk down the street in England and they say, well, what do you do? So I'm a 10K runner, and people just turn and walk away, you know, yawning. And in Japan, you'd say, what do you do? I say, oh, run 10Ks and marathons. They go, oh, that's so amazing. Like, oh, wow, really? Which one? You know, and there's a real feeling that there's a, you know, that everybody understands marathon in Japan. It's almost part of the culture, that the effort, the striving, you know, the suffering and the achievement, and, you know, the passion out there is incredible. So that's why I went to Japan. One of the reasons I went to Japan. The other reason was just to learn to be tougher, to learn to suffer a bit, because I was a bit of a wuss when it came to the marathon. I haven't ever run a great marathon, and never did. I managed to get a stress fracture before the actual realization of that particular dream, but certainly didn't do me any harm.
How long were you out there for?
I'd live out there for a few months at a time. I've never lived there long term, but I got the opportunity to train alongside a couple of the company running teams. So one, Asahikase, when I did a little bit of training, and I ostensibly trained with their women's teams, they had a half marathon runner who ran at 66, Chiba Masako. And she may still hold the Japanese half marathon record, I'm not sure. But when I was training with their runners, the men's team had, I think it was 7 runners sub 2:10. That's one team. And we went out to watch them train one day. They had a special road, Olympic Road, it's called. Running alongside a river, and they divided into two groups and did 10 times a K off a minute. And the A group ran average 2:42, and the B group averaged 2:44. It was just like incredible. And there's all the kind of running folklore around, you know, Toshihiko Seiko and, you know, running 70, 80K runs, and, you know, the Soul Brothers running 127K runs in New Zealand as part of these kind of, you know, it's about building the spirit as much as the body, you know. And that's what took me over there. But absolutely incredible. I had a Japanese coach for a while, and, you know, we'd be doing 20K runs on the track in 32 degrees centigrade and not being allowed to drink until 12K in. It was kind of, there were some interesting experiences. But I got off the plane in Atlanta in 1996, and other than the stretch fracture, I was like thinking, I literally felt like I was on holiday compared to the training. It wasn't hard, but, you know, had I actually been healthy, The intention was to try and do a Zatopek and run the 5K, 10K and marathon. But sadly, the doctor told me that if I did run the marathon, there was a good chance that the left tibia would completely break. So I settled for the 5 and 10K.
Well, I could go on for hours chatting, but I think we better, I'll ask you my final three questions.
I did warn you, I like to talk. Mate,
Well, I could be here for ages. But the last three questions are basically, do you have a favourite make and model of running shoe?
Yeah, I thought long and hard about this. There was a Japanese shoe called the Gel Tada, I think it was Gel Sorti Tada Japan, which was a super lightweight 130-gram running shoe, with a very, very low profile. Just bog standard EVA midsole. But I never, ever used to get Achilles pain running fast on the roads in that. And I don't know how or why. They stopped making them ages ago. But if I had a few dozen pairs of those, I'd be happy.
Yeah. And can you recommend a book or film or even podcast?
Okay, well, I'm going to go for Long Hard Road for the book. Anything that Ron Hill, you could read that every day for your whole life and still be motivated, couldn't you? My other If I can give another shout out to Japan Running News, Brett Lana's website, superb website. I'd recommend anybody and everybody checks it out. That's amazing. So that's my Sunday morning pre-long run motivation. Get up at six, see what's happened in Japan the night before. Brett's always, you know, written something or produced something that gives you a bit of pick me up, and then I'm out the door. So yeah, Japan Running News.
And the final question is, what's the greatest running or endurance performance of all time in your opinion?
Okay. Oh God. If I had to have one, it would have to be Rhodesia in London. If I have to have one, it would be Rhodesia in London. I think just for the timing, you know, again, world record on the night that it matters most, you know, running from the front and dragging everybody, including fellow Harlow 800 meter runner Andy Asaji, to incredible performances, and I'm glad that he's on his way back.
That's the, I think James T had exactly the same one. That's two in a row going for David Rudisi. It's a pretty good one.
You can't argue. I think Paula's marathon would be another one, but I equally, you know, Bikili's 10k, and I'm really tempted to sort of start thinking about Dave Moorcroft's, you know, 13:00 in 1982, because, you know, that was that was an incredible performance. But I think it's all about the context, isn't it? So I think for me, I like the story, you know, the backstory behind the performance. You know, the things are a little bit too predictable. So the sub two, you know, marathon, yeah, it's kind of interesting and a kind of academic, scientific sort of point of view. But it would be better still if it was produced by five guys smashing themselves to pieces in a real race.
Or Rat Wanjiru off on his own doing something crazy. He was a great
guy. Yeah, and another Japanese trained Kenyan. Yeah, Douglas Wakahuri was another one. So exactly. You need the characters to shine, and I hope it. I mean, I hope Kipchoge gets it. He'd be the one. I'd be really happy if he got it. But in a sense, it'd be nice if someone that nobody was thinking about just came out, and while everybody else was sort of worrying about their, you know, the sports drinks and the biomechanics, and it just snuck up on them and then, you know, took them to pieces. Yeah.
There's one guy I saw, I raced a couple of years ago in Bolzano. I was just there for there's a 10K there. And there's a guy called Toller. And I said at the time, this guy is going to be amazing, because he just looked so easy and tall and rangy. And I think he got a bronze in the 10,000 this year. Rio, but I think he just looks such a brilliant athlete. Hopefully he's my stick my neck out, he'll be a star in a few years time.
You heard it here first.
Nice one. Well, thanks for all your time, Noel. It's been excellent to chat, and
yeah, it's a pleasure, mate. I mean, I'm very fortunate. What am I now, like 12 years after retirement, that you're still interested. So I'm flattered, mate. So, you know, wish everybody a very successful 2017 season.